Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to yet another segment of the afternoon satsang on Bhagwan's African Odyssey. As we have stated earlier, every alternate fortnight we are taking up Bhagwan's visit to the African continent, specifically to the countries of Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda in the July of 1968. And we will be continuing where we left off last week, and I think I shall begin by making a humble and grateful salutation at Bhagwan's lotus feet on behalf of Prem, who is here with me, myself and all the listeners who have joined in this satsang, and quickly recap where we had left off last week. The last week we were on the 4th of July, a Thursday, when Bhagwan visited the Nairobi National Park. Bhagwan had arrived to Nairobi from Tanzania after seeing the Gorongoro Crater Reserve. And on the morning of the 4th of July, he, along with the others who had accompanied him, were taken to the National Park, which is present in Nairobi. There, Bhagwan visited the hippo pool, and Bhagwan also saw the lions, the ostriches, the giraffes, the cheetahs, all that, and it was a day filled with animal life, and a day filled with discourse on the fly, where Bhagwan emphasized on many wonderful aspects that we see in nature. Post lunch that day, Bhagwan was taken to Nanyuki, which is about 200 kilometers away, located bang on the equator. It's actually 0 degrees 1 minute north of the equator, at a height of about 6,400 feet above sea level. And this is the base for those who wish to climb Mount Kenya, which is about 14,000 feet above sea level. More than that, 16,000 feet above sea level. So we had stopped last week with this, where we said that the host, C.G. Patel, Dr. C.G. Patel, took Bhagwan and his entourage to Nanyuki with the idea of spending a night there at the Secret Valley Game Lodge. And it is from there that we shall pick up for this week in the satsang. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and right, we are in that Secret Valley Game Lodge. It's actually a very exclusive place from the description which was given. I think it's almost 170 odd miles from Nairobi.
Yeah, that's 200 kilometers.
Yeah, 200 kilometers. And that's how distant it was. You go right into the wildlife sanctuary, and there is a place where I think wildlife comes around the lodge where you're staying. And that's why the host was very keen on taking Swami there. It's almost like spending a day with the wildlife. The other one was visiting them. This was like you live and they come around you.
It was definitely a very dramatic change, because as they drove up to this place also, Professor Kasturi beautifully describes how the road, even in those days, 1968, it was a tarmac, very well laid out road, very comfortable journey. So though it was 200 kilometers, the journey was made quickly and comfortably. And it passed through the hills and dales. There were a lot of ups and downs in the road. And he says that they saw a lot of the settlements of the Kikuyu. Mm-hmm. The Kikuyu is the largest ethnic group in Kenya. And you remember, Prem, we were speaking about that tree. Kikuyu actually translates as the children of the sycamore tree. So okay. Africa and African culture have a lot of deep interconnection with the nature there, and that's why different tribes have as their foremost ancestors different trees. They call themselves as descendants of different trees. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many tribes are named that way. So the Kikuyu means the children of the sycamore tree, and as I said, they're the largest ethnic group in Kenya, and Professor Kasturi and the entourage got a chance to have a look at their humble dwellings made of plastered mud, and it was almost like a hut, but large, many of them. And as they drove through, they also came across a large number of coffee and sisal estates. These are the two things that sustain Kenya. Sisal From sisal, I think they make fibers, which is used for making cloth, different kind of things, you know.
Okay.
It's a fiber tree. So they passed through all these estates and, as you said, finally landed at this Secret Valley Game Lodge. This lodge actually is on top of a tree in the middle of the jungle. So you go and stay there. Therefore, you become part of nature. And you have to keep awake whole night because there's a lot of nocturnal life going on. And you watch the wildlife that is there. And because Swami is there, I think, you know, they want to ensure that he gets to see the speciality of that region. The speciality there was supposed to be the leopard. And therefore, the staff there at the Secret Valley Game Lodge had arranged for some meat to be placed as bait for the leopard to come. And they were not disappointed because that night, indeed, a leopard came. And not just a leopard had come along with her cubs as well. But before seeing the leopard, the group was lucky to view bisons and other animals, other most of the herbivores that were licking salt, eating grass all nearby. And then came their prime attraction, which was the leopard. And they saw the leopard and enjoyed darshan of wildlife.
Right, as Professor Kasturi writes, the leopards did not disappoint and they came on time. But who was really disappointed in the group was Swami himself. You know, because Swami was very upset for a couple of reasons. One thing was the very fact that they've brought Swami so much away from civilization. Swami was a bit upset because it was a Thursday evening. As Swami said, you know, on a Thursday evening where thousands of people would have been happy to spend the evening with Swami in bhajans.
Thursday is Swami's special day.
Right,
yeah.
And you brought me so far away into the jungle to see a leopard, right? You know, for Swami it must have been a pretty boring thing to do because, I mean, of course, it's all his creation itself. So Swami was a bit upset about that, and Swami went on to say that at least this being a Thursday, you could probably ask me some questions and I can answer them for you. And that's how Swami started the satsang for the evening, and then they started asking. And I think what would have been a disappointing evening for the host, because you know, at the end of the day, you're trying to make Swami happy and you're trying to give the best of the place Swami is visiting to Swami, and if Swami is unhappy with it, that there's no point, right? You know, everybody else might be excited about it, Professor Kasturi and all the others joining Swami, but if Swami is upset about it, there's no point. But Swami did not disappoint the host because Swami turned that evening into such a memorable one after this satsang began as they started asking questions. Right?
Before we actually go into the content matter of what Swami spoke during the satsang, here's one thought that arose, you know, when I read that Swami was disappointed being among the animals. See, because when, as you said, the animals are also his creation, they are also his children, the humans are also his children, then why is Swami partial towards the humans? See, from a physical point of view, it's not that he's partial, because he's visiting both. But you see, it is very evident that for Swami, though he may be near the humans, though he may be near the animals, even in Prashanta Nilayam, he had the deer, he had Sai Gita, he had animals around. It's not that physically he has distanced himself from animals. But in dearness, definitely humans seem to score over the animals. And I feel that is something very deep, because all said and done, it's only man who has been endowed with this capacity of discrimination, with the capacity to choose something over the other, and capacity to evolve and become God. That's why Swami says, you know, man is a crest jewel of creation. I created him in my own image. So, though God physically can be near the animal or near the human being, I think in dearness, human being scores over. So, though Swami is, you know, you never have a case where Swami is, you know, amidst the devotees and saying, you know, gosh, I miss the zebra there. I miss the ostrich or I miss the leopard. No. But there are so many instances in this African visit where Swami is amidst the animals and he says, you know, I miss my devotees. I felt this is an important lesson for us, because in the evolution, we see that physical evolution ends, but from man begins the spiritual evolution. An evolution that animals can't participate in. And it appears as if the higher you are on the spiritual evolutionary ladder, the dearer you are to Swami. You may not be near Swami, you may not be physically close to Swami, but you definitely are dearer to Swami, and Swami actually misses being with you. That's what is evident here, and that should inspire us to actually put in efforts, do our sadhana, to grow higher in the spiritual ladder, because Whether we get nearness or not, it depends on the karma and depends on so many other things. But dearness is something that definitely we can all strive through our own efforts and sadhana.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things which Swami has constantly done throughout this trip, and every opportunity that he had, he went into the crowd, he went into the group and asking them, do you have any questions? Because one thing which Swami would often say is, man, I have no desires, I am desireless. And the only desire I have is to make you desireless, right? So Swami would say that that is probably the purpose of the avatar itself. And that, by extension, is the purpose of every visit, every travel that Swami made. Every time when Swami went into a function, a program, into somebody's house, or invited people into interview, for his interviews. The whole idea was to give you an opportunity to grow spiritually. And as you said, this opportunity of being in Swami's presence, the way we deal with it or the way we utilize it, changes with the level of understanding you are in. And that's why Swami would often say that give up the animal nature and come to the human nature. Because it's not that the animal nature is bad or animal nature is wrong per se. Of course, the animal nature in a human being is wrong.
Mm.
But by itself, the animal nature is not wrong. But you don't have the opportunity to progress as much if you are in the level of a human being. If you are in the state where you are, you know, adhering to the human values. So that's why I think in that sense, every minute of Swami was so precious. When spent with the animals, I'm sure Swami is, I think in a discourse, Swami said, even the animals did not have any fear. They came near Swami and Swami would speak about the animals. You spoke about the deers and Swami would speak so much about them and how they enjoyed Swami's company. But their enjoyment probably stops at the level of enjoyment. And here you have an opportunity for growth, for progress, for evolution, as you said. And that is why constantly Swami was saying that, you know, use me. I've come here all the way. And from Swami's point of view, he knew that this was the only trip abroad. Right? So he really wanted him to be made use of in that sense. Made use to come closer to him.
It is not surprising, therefore, that night the discourse that Swami gave to the entourage was on how one should focus on taming the animals that roam the mind.
Right.
You know, how to overcome one's animal tendencies and, yes, subdue these lower instincts so that the higher intuition can get a chance to express itself. Over there, the entire discourse was centered around one theme, and the powerful point that came out was Swami said that whatever the mind fixes itself upon, the mind takes a form of that. And therefore it is so important that we fill our mind. We usually fill our mind through our senses. Therefore, it is important that we sanctify our senses, because the senses are the way in which the mind actually drinks on something, feasts or something, on something, or absorbs something. And therefore, you know, if the mind is focused on the lower things, that's what we become. If the mind is focused on the higher things, that's what we become. No wonder Swami says, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. The mind alone is responsible both for your bondage as well as for your liberation. And in order to make this point clear, Swami there in Africa gave the example of the fly versus the honeybee. Said both of them are, you know, in seeking things to draw sustenance from, while the honeybee sits only on the flowers and draws nectar. The fly sits about everywhere, on garbage, on rubbish, everywhere it sits. And therefore, while the honeybee is adored and looked up to and, you know, quoted as a positive example, the fly is always quoted as a negative example. And Swami emphasized that our mind should be like that honeybee, which selectively goes and picks only the nectar, and not like a fly that is available to mop up and sop up, swab up everything, all kinds of nonsense, rubbish or dirt that lies everywhere around. That was the focus, central focus of his discourse that night.
Right, and as it's documented, when asked what questions you want, that's how the discussion came to that, because people asked about mind control. And it's an interesting thing. I think invariably when Swami says, ask any questions, the first question is, Swami, how to control the mind. I mean, I can say that on the basis of every discussion we've been a part of when, you know, when we were students. Because invariably, even in Trai Vrindavan or in the bhajan
hall. Definitely. Anecdotal evidence suggests that that is one of the foremost.
Everybody, in fact, I know a couple of times when Swami got upset when the students were asking repeatedly the same thing. Because on that occasion, Swami said, see, everything that I speak of, every discipline that I put you through, is meant for this mind control. Right, and there is nothing new because we keep asking for techniques and, you know, probably what do you call
shortcuts, quick fixes.
What do you call in gaming? It's called some tricks, right? You ask for
cheat codes,
right? Swami says there is nothing. Everything is about mind control, and as Swami is saying, and in fact, some of the discussions which are going to follow with the later groups which are going to come, Swami so beautifully speaks about this. This very thing, you know, how do you focus your mind? And that's how Swami starts. And the next thing which Swami does is very beautiful because, again, as I said, all of this what Swami did is actually built into that idea of how to control the mind, how to sublimate the mind.
Before you go to what Swami did, you know, a few thoughts that came here is when Swami says, bend your body, mend the senses.
And the mind.
End your senses, mend the mind. Mend your senses, end the mind.
Right, end
yes.
The mind.
So that itself shows the way to mind control. You know, it starts with the senses. And Swami says, this is what even Bhagwan Krishna says in the Gita, where he says that whatever the mind dwells upon, it gets attached to it. That attachment leads to anger. And, you know, he gives a whole cycle of how it leads to ultimate destruction of one's discrimination.
Right.
Therefore, the key point over here is to ensure that what our mind dwells upon is worth being dwelt upon. You know, let us not dwell on things that are not worthwhile, because unconsciously the amount of time we spend on it, the quantity of time and the quality of time that we spend on it, is what determines who we become. And therefore, you know, it is a very, very important thing. And when you were saying about how it is one of the most common things asked, I remember on one occasion, this was sometime in 2006, I think, maybe, when Bhagwan used to give darshan in that red Maruti Esteem car.
Mm-hmm.
He would be sitting in the front. So one day when he was coming for darshan, I noticed that the glass was down. So the car, when it slowed down near me, I just got up on my knees and, you know, this is an opportunity. A great opportunity to ask something, and it's not like at that point in time I was going through some trouble or something, but you know, we keep some standard set of questions that if ever I get a chance, let me ask this from Swami. So since I got the chance, guess what? The foremost question that came in my mind was, Swami, please help me control my mind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him, Swami, please help me control my mind. Swami, I had told him in Kannada, so he responded in Kannada, and he asked, Nimma mind now control. Now control Madhveka, he asked, your mind and you want me to control it? So I didn't know what to say, so I said, okay Swami, I will control it, but please give me the strength to control it.
Mm.
And then Swami said, no need, I've already given the strength, there's nothing. So basically he put the ball back in my court, saying that if you're saying you're not able to control the mind, you're just not doing the effort that is necessary. Don't blame God saying that he hasn't given enough strength. He hasn't given enough whatever qualities. Everything, Swami said, I have already given all that has to be given. It's only up to you to make the effort. And I think that is probably the reason why most of us, most of the time, ask Swami this question. Because we are always looking for something on a platter and not ready to bend our body and slog ourselves out in order to achieve it.
Exactly, and I think that's central to Swami's approach to, you know, mind control itself. That thought that you already have it in you to do it. You already have the ability. In fact, one of the other classic examples I can think of is when Swami looked at one of our lecturers when he was a student, and Swami asked him, "Intra ilau naura?" And he said, "Yes, Swami, I'm fine." Swami said, "No, you're not fine." So then Swami said, "Your mind is up and down, bumps and jumps, bumps and jumps." And, you know, is after all a young person, he went up to Swami and said, "Yes, Swami, that's true, that's how it is." Then he said, "Swami, you should help me. How do I control my mind?" You know, the same question. And that time, you know, Swami gave a very beautiful analogy, and he said it was so empowering for him, and it gave him so much confidence in mm-hmm. himself. When Swami took one of his handkerchiefs, and this was in the early 80s maybe, when Swami was still having paan, right? Mm. So Swami picked up one of his handkerchiefs and Swami said, "See this handkerchief. And Swami pointed to the paan marks. And Swami said, why,
the red stain.
Right, why are these stains there in this handkerchief? And he was quiet. Then Swami went on to say, it's because I used the handkerchief. Right? Swami said, because I used the handkerchief, it becomes dirty. So what do I do when it becomes dirty? I throw it to the dobi. No? Chakali vadu, Swami would say. I give it to the dobi. And then he gives it back to me. And then Swami said, does the dobi make the cloth white? Does the dobi make the handkerchief white? No, he doesn't do that. He removes what was not part of the handkerchief and he restores it to its whiteness and he gives it back to me. Right? And Swami said, same is the case with your mind. Because you use your mind for the various activities throughout the day, it gets stained. But that is not what your mind is. You know, that's a stain of the mind.
And Swami said, on the mind.
Right, right, okay. On the mind. It's not the nature of the mind. And Swami said, all that you have to do is give it to the dobi. And Swami pointed to himself and said, I am the dobi.
Washerman.
Right? Mm. Give your mind to me and I will restore it to its natural whiteness. It's not like I am going to transform it into something else or make it good. I'm going to restore it to what it really is. And he said, you know, it was so very empowering for him because Swami is saying, by nature you're pure. Right? You know, here is a person who is feeling guilty about probably bad thoughts which he's getting or not able to control his mind. And Swami is saying that that's not your nature because by nature you're pure. It's just that with use it's become dirty.
You know, it reminds us of the song, Maili Chadar Ode Ke Kaise. You know, that song, actually I think it has been sung by Anoop Jalota and different people. But it's along these themes only. It says that, oh Lord, you gave me this mind, you gave me this body which is so pure. He speaks of how much effort the Lord put in to create this pure body and mind. And he says, but Lord, throughout my life I have dirtied it so much. And it is so dirty that I am feeling ashamed to come to your doorstep, because I'm guilty that I have soiled something that was so pure and given to me. No wonder that student there felt so empowered, because what Swami said was almost like an answer to this song, where Swami is saying, you don't have to worry even if it's dirty. It gets dirty with use. You need not feel guilty about it. Just like your clothes, whenever you use it, it gets dirty. It also gets dirty. Don't feel shy. Come and give it to the dhobi. I am there to wash it, and because by nature you are pure. As you rightly said, it's very empowering to listen to that. On that note, dear listeners, I think this is a perfect time that we take a quick break. Listen to that very song, Maili Chadar Ode Ke Kaise. And on the other side of the song, we will continue with Bhagwan's visit to that particular Secret Valley Lodge where some really interesting things happened.
Maili Chadar Ode Ke Kaise Dwar Tumhare Aaun, Maili Chadar Ode Ke Kaise Ke Pavan Parmeshwar Mere Ke Pavan Parmeshwar Mere Man Hi Man Sharmao Maili Chadar Odh Ke Kaise Dwar Tumhare Aao Maili Chadar Odh Ke Kaise Yeah.
Well, that's from a drama which was staged in front of Swami. It was drama on Surdas, because there's a song is written by Saint Surdas among
I think it was 1994 convocation.
Right, among the many beautiful songs that he has written, this was one of them, and definitely it's a song Swami has chosen to be in the drama. But as you're saying, you know, that is the feeling, and what I was telling just before we went into that break, it's because, you know, this is precisely the approach of Swami. Saying that this is your nature, it's not like you need to become something or you need, you know, you're animal, you should become a human being and you should become divine. Swami says, essentially you are divine, you just have to shed what you're not. And that is precisely the line of argument which Swami takes. And what Swami told him, you know, I am the dhobi and you give your mind to me. It is all about that, and that is precisely what Swami was doing even during the trip. Swami was giving them, giving them memories which are going to be filled, which are going to fill the mind, because that is what will transform and purify the mind. And to add to one of those memories that Swami was going to give them, Swami sitting there suddenly waved his hand and materialized something very beautiful.
Yes, he materialized a jeweled pendant actually. It was made of enamel and gold, marvelous to look at, and just gave it to one member of the entourage saying, you have been longing for this from a long time, right? You know, so that person was very thrilled, of course. And Swami immediately said, I know all of you others who have not got it are feeling bad because you also wish to get something. It's not like you're jealous of him or anything, but yeah, you also wish to get something. And therefore, Swami then waved his hand once again. And on that beautiful Thursday evening, you know, Thursday is Swami's own day, when Bhagwan declared his avatarhood, he had actually commanded that you worship me on Thursdays. So it is that such a kind of a Thursday, a special Thursday, when Swami waved his hand and materialized a golden bottle which had a screw cap, and he slowly unscrewed the cap, waved his hand, materialized a golden spoon. Then from that bottle, he poured out a liquid onto the spoon and distributed to everyone there. Yes, needless to say, it was that nectar, it was Amrita, and were they all thrilled, to say the least. You know, they were all in cloud 9, the 7th heaven, whatever, you know, you can say, very, very happy as they received this divine blessing on a Thursday. In fact, Professor Kasturi writes that as the compassion of nature, as she showers rain on a parched or drought-struck land, he says that's how we were feeling actually. You know, because Swami has apparently been a little upset, saying that instead of being amidst devotees, you have simply brought me here. What is this? You know, this is like a waste of time. And definitely that, in when Swami is in that mood, that too, no, I have not seen it. We have just heard it that over age, over time, physically Swami at least mellowed down. His anger and irritation of the 60s and 70s, they say, is something, nothing short of a fury actually. So I don't know how it might have been. So in that kind of a mood when Bhagwan is, I don't think they would have expected this kind of a shower of grace and love. But as Swami says, like an actor puts on different moods to suit the drama and convey the whatever the meaning or the purpose of the drama, that is how it is. He has neither anger nor attachment. And it is, these are all the different masks that he put on. And therefore, it's actually no big deal for him to shift from a so-called bad mood to a so-called good mood. But that's what Bhagwan did. He materialized this and he gave Amrita to all of them, thrilling everyone and filling their hearts with ecstasy.
Right. And that's how he made that visit memorable. And also, Professor Kasturi writes, in the middle of wildlife, 11,000 feet above, you know, sea level, to have this sudden grace, you know, showered on all of them. As you said, it'll be something which they will remember, because, you know, as I was just recollecting what Swami was saying then, you know, we all have seen it, you know, when you put a program in front of Swami or when you give a speech in front of Swami, you'd have the entire audience applauding, but if you don't find that smile of appreciation on Swami's face, I mean, how much ever people might, 100 people might come and shake your hands and say you spoke well, but if you feel that you've not pleased Swami, it's going to leave a huge, you know, burden on your heart. But Swami lifted it by this act and he changed the entire evening, because after this event, Swami called the owner of that lodge, the Secret Valley Lodge which they were staying in. He happened to be a Muslim gentleman. And as soon as he came, Swami said, you've been suffering from enlarged tonsils. Right? And he was surprised. that he had not told anybody about it in the group, and Swami was bringing the topic up, and Swami materializes Vibhuti to him and gives it to him, and Swami says, don't worry, you'll be, you know, the ailment will be taken care of.
He in fact also materializes a photograph of himself and right. gives it to this man, and also speaks to the other servants or, you know, people who were there to help in the upkeep of the lodge. So Swami speaks to them also. Another interesting thing that happens is, Swami is told that a group of people had traveled from the interiors of Africa, knowing that it is difficult for them to travel all the way to Nairobi,
right.
but this is somewhere close to their place, and therefore they would like to meet Swami, and they had come. And Kasturi Garu records that in that group was one half-blind boy, the father of whom was hoping for some kind of relief from Bhagwan. And Swami, in all compassion and love, you know, asked that these people be brought to Nairobi. Because the next morning, I think Swami left for Nairobi. And he said that, let them be brought to Nairobi, I will see them later. Probably because you are in the middle of the night, in the middle of the jungle, and it's quite late at night. And that's what actually happened. You know, I'm just jumping a little ahead in the story. But the next day when Swami was in Nairobi, Professor Kasturi writes that this group, the host ensured that these people were brought, and Swami granted them an interview. And Kasturi Garu writes that when the interview got over and they all came out, all of them had tears of joy in the eye. So we don't know actually what happened to the half-blind boy, whether he got cured or not, but whatever it was, definitely all their eyes were brimming with tears of joy. And that's what Bhagwan, that could possibly be considered as a symbol of what Bhagwan was doing in Africa, calling people and filling them with delight and ananda.
And it's very interesting, you know, when they say that they've already traveled so far to reach Swami in that jungle, and Swami saying that, no, you come to Nairobi. In fact, Swami told them, I'll wait till you come. I will not leave before you come.
Because Swami next day had to leave for Kampala.
Right. I had to leave for Kampala. It's almost like a very small test of faith that Swami was giving them. Because they could probably ask, you know, if he can cure, why not cure here? Why insist that we should come to Nairobi? And just we spoke about tonsils being cured just there in the middle of nowhere. But that's probably the test of faith that Swami is giving. And, you know, there's so many accounts of Swami making a person, a dumb boy speak, a blind see. And I think a lot of people in Africa, because a lot of them had embraced Christianity, would have been able to relate to such miracles more than anything else. Because, you know, talking about Africa and talking about devotees from Africa, one of the most legendary among them is Victor Kanu. You know, he says that his first introduction to Swami was like that, when he had gone to a prayer meeting. There, one of the ladies who was speaking there, he said, do you know there is one young man in South India, his name is Satyasai Baba. He's doing exactly what Jesus Christ did 2000 years ago. And he said that was the most striking thing. And that's precisely what Swami was doing. You know, these are all typically episodes which are recorded in the Bible, you know, making the dumb speak, making the lame walk, and all of that. And precisely Swami was doing that. In fact, Victor Kanu says the first time he was in the interview room with Swami in Vrindavan, there was another lady who was there, I think an Italian lady on a wheelchair, who was right across the room in the corner. And Swami looks at her and Swami says, get up and come here. And she does get up with a lot of trepidation and walks all the way to Swami. And he says, I mean, this is what Jesus did. And, you know, so beautifully he records that the Bible says that Jesus did this after praying to the Master, and he is doing it on his own command.
Yes, Swami did not pray to
somebody else, or, you know, take a moment to pray, make a prayer for the cure.
Well, Jesus prayed to his Father who art in heaven.
And he said that really struck him. And so many such episodes have been recorded in this one trip that Swami made to Africa. Right?
Absolutely. And yes, so that night passed there at the Secret Valley Game Lodge. And the next day morning, I think the 5th of July, which was a Friday. So this was time to depart from there. And from Nanyuki, Swami returned back to Nairobi. Of course, needless to say, Professor Kasturi has summarized the return visit by just saying that he had to make multiple stops for darshan to the thirsting hundreds and thousands on the way. And after multiple stops, Swami reaches Nairobi. And again, there are people waiting because they know that Swami is now leaving for Kampala. And it was at Kampala Dr. C.G. Patel, Swami's host, had his home.
Right.
So it was natural that Swami would be spending maximum amount of time in Africa at Kampala in Uganda. So that day he had spent almost 2 full days at Nairobi, and now it was time to leave for Kampala. So thousands had gathered, and in fact the barricades were not enough to hold back these surging thousands. Many of them tried to break through the barricades, tried to grab a piece of Swami, you know, almost like that, touch his feet or touch his robe. That was when Swami also started telling everyone that this is not what is expected of a Sai devotee. A discipline is something that is very, very important. So Swami emphasizes that it's important for these Sai devotees to be disciplined and not break lines. And he actually disciplines the crowd by speaking about discipline before actually getting into the flight to travel to Kampala. Of course, the flight is over the Rift Valley, over the harbor town of Kisumu in Kenya, before finally landing in Kampala at the Entebbe Airport on the shores of Lake Victoria.
And then he continues the narrative as it happens in Kampala, because he says, as you were saying, 2 days away from Kampala, he says almost 50 hours Swami was away, and you know, you could see that pangs of separation on the people who had gathered there that evening to have Swami's darshan. And he says that hundreds of them handed letters to Swami saying that, Swami, we missed you so much in those 50 hours. And in the process of expressing their distress in missing Swami, they also extrapolated to the idea that, Swami, they say that you're going to leave soon.
On 10th.
And we can't but imagine what our plight will be when you leave. And they were all praying to Swami to extend his stay for a little longer. And many of them, of course, wrote saying that, Swami, please take me along with you. I would like to come back to India with you and be of service in your mission.
It's very interesting to note here, because it only adds to what you just now said, Prem, that the African people would have identified well, because most of them had converted to Christianity or they were practicing Christians. Because Kasturi records that most of the people who wrote to Swami or spoke to Swami or even held placards, you know, they all said, Father, do not leave us. So I think this concept of seeing the Supreme Lord as a Father,
right,
it comes in Christianity most predominantly, and that is what it was. Multiple letters were there, and everybody had this common prayer that, Father, don't leave us, Father, don't leave us. So the father's heart melted, and unknown to all the people in Africa, Swami actually sent a cable. That's what Kasturi Garu records, that he sent a cable to India saying, the return has been postponed, don't expect Bhagwan to be back on 10th. Because 10th of July was Guru Purnima, and the original plan was early morning Swami leaves so that he can be in India for Guru Purnima.
Right.
So that got postponed when Bhagwan sent a cable. Of course, at that point in time, the people in Africa did not know it. So as we go ahead with each passing day, we will see that the pining and intensity of longing where they're requesting Swami to stay back, it keeps increasing.
Right. And looking at this gathering, as you're saying, that the predominant number of people whom Swami was interacting with and who were making this prayer were the Africans, and somebody in the entourage, probably the host or the people who were traveling with Swami, made this statement that, you know, now the Sai family includes even Africans. And he must have thought that it's a very wise thing to say, or a remark which will probably Swami will appreciate. But Swami was very upset with the remark, and quite so, because, you know, Professor Kasturi writes, I'll probably read out that, because it's a very famous quote of Swami too, where Swami reminded them, where Swami said, do not tell me of a new Sai family. I am Sanatana, ancient and eternal, come as Nutana, the new. Shall I tell you who the constituents of the Sai family are? The family of every Sai devotee? His father is truth. His mother is love. His wife or husband is detachment. His son, wisdom. His daughter, fortitude. His kith and kin, the good. His friends and companions, the sages and saints. Such is the Sai family. You speak of the Sai family believing yourselves to be Sai devotees. But it is not enough if you label yourself as devotees. I must accept you as such. And I will accept only when you act up the teachings I give. And they are not difficult either. but true. Be true, be just, be full of love, remain unaffected by the ups and downs of life. Take everything as signs of grace.
What a message. So many times, you know, Bhagwan says actually that Satya is your father, Prema is your mother, Vairagya is your spouse.
Right.
It's interesting, you know, spouse, husband, wife, your husband or your wife is somebody to whom you are most attached to. And Swami here says that in a Sai family, your spouse is Vairagya, detachment. You know, detachment is your spouse. Whereas we associate attachment to spouse with attachment. Swami says a spouse is given, it's almost like a spouse is given to you so that you practice detachment. It's a very interesting and deep thought. And Swami says, jnana or wisdom is your son. You know, when they say the child is the father of man, so much to learn. Swami says, kshama is your daughter. The sant, sadhu, they are your relatives and your friends. This is really something for us to think so much about. And it's amazing how single statements from Bhagwan, whatever their flow might be, they actually encapsulate his entire message. And you know, when Swami says that it's not enough if you label yourself as Sai devotees. You know, just this little anecdote that I was telling you, happened to meet this person who claims that he has been coming to Bhagwan from the 70s and he was being pretty critical of what we are doing at Radio Sai, saying that you're not doing enough, you should do this, you should do that. And this went on for some time and I heard him out, and that is when I realized that this person apparently is not familiar with our website, is not familiar with our YouTube page, nothing. When I started listing out the things that we have, oh, he was surprised. And I, at that point in time, honestly, Prem, I felt very hurt. And I also felt a little angry. Mm-hmm. I said, you have not put in this much effort to go through, and you have the cheek to come and tell me that I have some feedback to give you. You know, and I might have lost my cool a little bit. It's my mistake, but it happened. You know, I spoke little firmly and strongly to him, telling that it's a problem with your inclination. You don't have an inclination to visit and see this. You better go through this and then come up with all your feedback and suggestions. You have not even gone through the site, and how can you come up and tell this is a feedback? You know, now when I look at it, I'm just thinking how angry or upset should Swami be? Because, you know, Swami has so beautifully given all his message. In fact, we have got 800 discourses that Bhagwan delivered, and they're available for free on the website. You can sit and listen for all kinds of problems, for everything he has given. And we come to Swami and say, Swami, help me in this. I don't know what to do. What should I do? How must Swami feel? And yet, Bhagwan is compassionate, loving, kshama. He has all this. Kshama is his daughter, jnana is his son, you know, Prema is his mother, Satya is his father. He is an embodiment of Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema, and all these, Vairagya. And that is the reason why when we repeatedly bored into him with the same questions, he still answered with all love, all compassion, and all magnitude of, you know, I just don't know what to say. I just thinking of Swami in comparison to what my reaction was today, my, you know, heart just overwhelms with gratitude to him for being so loving and such an epitome of forbearance and patience towards all of us.
And I think, you know, that point which Swami is making, that you, it's not about you declaring yourself as a devotee, because I think a lot of us go around telling that I am a Sai devotee, especially where it's useful, because a lot of us hesitate to wear that identity on our sleeve, where, you know, where people are not ready to accept that, but at the same time, where it is useful. You know, you've seen that a lot of people, you know, where you visit a new place and you want to use the identity that you're a Sai devotee, you're very happily using it. But I think the true thing is that question of, have I lived my life? Am I living my life in a way that Swami can call me as a devotee? In fact, I think Dr. Samuel Sandwise was narrating the last few days of Dr. Hislop. You know, when he was in his last few days, a lot of these devotees from America would go and visit him just to spend some time with him. And Dr. Samuel Sandwise would say that when he had gone there, the question that Hislop would constantly keep asking is, what do you think? Am I living my life the way Swami would want me to? You know, there on the bed the last few days, he was asking constantly, am I living my life the way Swami would want me to? Am I living the life the way Swami would want me to? I think that's the definition of a real devotee. Where till the end, probably it's a doubt, you know, probably you're confused and you're not confident about it, but still, that is the only thing which is burning within you. And that's what defines you. And that's what Swami says.
More than doubt, I feel, Prem, it's a kind of dissatisfaction. In spite of, you know, we know what all Hislop has done. And in spite of doing all that, you're not satisfied. And that's why you feel that, that's why that it expresses itself as a doubt. So, I feel that is definitely a hallmark of a devotee where we are not satisfied. We don't sit back and say, this much I have done, that's it. Now I am a qualified devotee. Now I can go about and do whatever I wish. It is a journey that never ends, because the moment it ends, we cease to be a devotee. From a Sai devotee, we have become Sai. That is the only time when the journey ends. So as long as we are Sai devotees, we can't say that, that's it. Now I have done everything and I am a qualified Sai devotee.
Right. And that's precisely what Swami was pointing at. You know, don't just include yourself in the Sai family, but you do what you're supposed to do. After this, of course, Swami starts meeting a lot of people. There are different groups that Swami interacts with as groups. You know, apart from the hundreds that Swami is picking for interviews, there were now people visiting Swami as groups, as, you know, forming different functional groups. We'll come to that. Probably we'll take a short break and we'll continue with the narration in the second part of Swami's visit to Kampala after his return from Nairobi. We'll continue after this short break.
Yeah.
Welcome, my dear listeners. We're talking about Swami's visit to East Africa. We spoke about how Swami went to Nairobi and visited wildlife from Nairobi. He went out and now he's come back to Kampala and we're talking about the second half of the visit to Kampala, literally. And as we said, Swami was, going out and giving darshan after about 2 days, more interactions with the native African crowd. But on that day, Swami also had a lot of other people visiting him. Like he said, Professor Kasturi records how the Indian High Commissioner to Uganda, he visited Swami on that day.
Shri K.P.R. Singh.
K.P.R. Singh. And of course, you have these Lions Club and Rotary Club in all places, especially in countries where I think there was a lot of the British rule influence was there. I think even in India in those days we had. So those people, the Rotarians and the Lions, as they are called, they wanted an audience with Swami, which Swami, of course, obliged.
There was an audience with the lawyers. There was an audience with the doctors. There was an audience with audience to the officers of the immigration department in Uganda. You know, these immigration department, they had come to know about Swami's departure. They had an advanced knowledge and because on 10th Swami's leaving, they thought, even they did not know that Swami had
extended it.
So they thought that this is the chance we should come and have darshan. And I felt, this is a way a true devotee uses his influence or power in the world to get to God. We were the other day speaking of two kinds of people. One kind who uses the world in order to get to God. The other kind that uses God in order to get to the world. Let's all pray that we are in the former category and not the latter. So there were many visits. In fact, I think it was possible, probably this weekend that Idi Amin, who was holding one of the prominent positions in the Ugandan army, also visited Swami at C.G. Patel's house. So all this happened, but today possibly, Prem, let's focus on one particular doctor who happened to get an interview along with all the doctors who were called in, and that is Dr. Kishan Gadia, whom Swami in the later years used to refer affectionately as Krishna. So Dr. Kishan Gadia, whose story is very, very interesting, and possibly today we'll just have time to cover the different aspects of his story with Bhagwan. So Dr. Kishan Gadia actually had come to Uganda in 1965, and before he came in 1965, much before him, his elder brother had already come, and I think in 1958 or something.
He came to Puttaparthi in 1965.
Correct. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Living in Kampala for two generations, and I think
yes, born and brought up there.
Right. 1965, he was studying for his medicine in Gujarat. I think that's how, with his friends, he visits Swami. And as you were saying, his elder brother, who's also a doctor, Dr. Gadia, is actually the senior doctor whom we all have seen. I don't know, when I was a student, I still used to see him, and Swami used to very, very lovingly interact with
him. He's given a few talks as well.
Very, very elderly gentleman. And he had come to Swami in the 1950s. That's how the family was introduced to Swami. And later in 1965, Kishan Gadia himself had come to see Swami.
So his brother had set up a center, a Sathya Sai center in Kampala, way back in 1958 itself.
Right.
And as we said in the beginning of the series, they had all made repeated requests for Bhagwan to come to Uganda, and Dr. C.G. Patel had almost 9 times booked and cancelled before Swami actually visited. So in 1965, when Dr. Kishan Gadia got an interview with Bhagwan in Prashanthi Nilayam, it was going to be a life-changing one. He says, because that visit, when he had to leave back, Swami came walking, and possibly in the portico or in the darshan grounds, Swami spoke to him and asked him, "You are leaving today?" He said, "Yes, I am leaving." And Swami materialized for him a visiting card. A visiting card, Bhagwan Sri Sat Sai Baba, Bukkapatnam, Penukonda, that which many of us might have seen. If not, we can just search for it on the web.
I think many of these materialization, Professor Kasturi speaks about during the Africa trip, where he says that Swami gave them a portrait of himself. Many of it must have been this, because it was a very common thing that Swami used to give.
A visiting card.
Right. A lot of students have also received that. It's almost like a visiting card, which Swami would say, keep it always with you.
A portrait on one side and his address on the other
right.
side. Yes. So, Swami gave this to him and precisely he told this only. He said, don't keep it in the altar or anywhere. Let it always be with you in your wallet. It would have great bearing in the story later on. So that is how he left. And in 1968, when Bhagwan visited, during this visit, it is natural that Dr. Kishan Gadia was excited, but he was staying about 80 kilometers away, you know. Away he was staying at a place where he had set up his practice. And therefore, he could not visit Swami during the week. And therefore, he decided to visit Bhagwan during the weekend. And in the weekend, this was a weekend, the 5th of July was actually a Saturday. And he left his job, he didn't leave his job, it was a holiday. He was working at the Mulago Hospital. It's a famous hospital in Kampala. Mm-hmm. So, he came and sat for darshan and was pleasantly surprised and thrilled actually when Swami called all the doctors in for an interview. And during the interview, many interesting things happened. One of which was Swami telling him that, tomorrow I'm going to come home, be ready. And he was very thrilled. So, I think at this point in time, we'll slightly go ahead with the story. 5th was Saturday, so on 6th, which was a Sunday, Bhagwan actually visited the home of Dr. Kishan Gadia. They had bhajans there and aarti. After which, you know, they offered grapes to Swami and Swami was eating the grapes, which were very, very sweet. Something interesting happened as Bhagwan ate these grapes. Bhagwan put it in his mouth and then said that, see, your present life is sweet like these grapes, but the future will not be. In the sense that just as these grapes will rot and become sour and bitter and not good for consumption, that's what will happen also. And therefore Swami said that take your family, sell everything, leave Uganda, go out of Uganda. That is when Dr. Kishan Gadia said, Swami, but I'm holding a British passport. So Swami said, so what? So go to Britain then, you know. Just leave Uganda. And that was something very, very important, because Dr. Kishan Gadia says in his interview with Ted Henry is present on the Soul Journey channel in YouTube, and anybody can visit it and have a look at this whole interview. But he says that at that point in time, 1968, everything was going on so well. Everything was going on so fine. And what Swami was saying was very, very disruptive. They had a successful textile business and selling everything and relocating to UK at that point in time seemed like a very, very crazy and drastic step. But Swami had said it, and therefore, Dr. Kishan Gadia says that because Swami said it, he sold his... You know, his family was in the business, but he was a doctor himself. But he sold his practice in the sense, he gave up all his immovable properties. He began to live in a rented place. He converted everything into money and had his money transferred to his London bank account. So he did all this as per what Swami said, because Swami had told him to leave. The only reason he didn't leave and stayed on was because his parents, who were doing this cloth business successfully, were very reluctant. And they said, what can possibly happen that, you know, makes us run out of here?
I mean, if they've been living there for two generations, they've actually already seen some regime changes.
Yes, yes,
from,
yes, correct.
British rule to the local government. And they've seen that. And and I think that was a time when nothing really happened to the business class, especially which was...
running the economy of the country.
Which was comprised of predominantly the Asians. They were
in that
doing
Indians
well.
And mm-hmm. among Indians the people from Gujarat,
right? So they were not very keen to make the shift, and in fact Dr. Kishan Gadia speaks about Swami telling them directly this. I'm sure in many of the interactions we've spoken about that Swami spoke to family, Swami spoke to these groups, Swami must have hinted this to a lot of them, because many people moved out of Uganda because Swami had told them that it is time to find ways of moving your practice outside.
And if we look fast forward a little bit and look at it, I think the purge, if I may use that term, the purge of Asians and Indians began in 1973.
Right, 4 or 5 years later.
5 years later when Idi Amin became the president of Uganda. And it's amazing, you know, that Swami dropped this hint. It's amazing that Swami met Idi Amin. Possibly we will cover that in some other satsang of the interaction between Idi Amin and Swami. But Swami met Idi Amin. Swami is meeting with the Indians. And if we go to the history of why this happened, it's available. It's all there in the World Wide Web. But from the research, if we just go through, basically what happened was the British, when they captured different colonies, they didn't try to, you know, bring up that colony to speed. In the sense, it's not like they established top quality schools. They did, of course. In India, they have established some schools. But everything was done to suit their purpose. And now that they had Indians who were ready to work hard for and ready to, you know, be good slaves. So what they did was, they transported Indians to different colonies. So whatever the colony lacked, it would be made up by transporting or actually importing Indians from India there. So there are certain colonies, for example in Sri Lanka, if you look at it, I was speaking to a devotee from Sri Lanka, and so there they lacked in education.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at that, most of the people from Tamil origin, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because that Tamil Nadu, that is a culture that is very close to Sri Lanka, and they were transported there in order to make up for the education, you know, because mm-hmm. Sri Lanka was also a British colony. Now in Africa, they lack trade and commerce. So Indians who are good at trade and commerce, naturally high in that list come the people from Gujarat, the Gujaratis. So they were transported, they were imported from India and put in Africa. So that is one reason why you will see in all the former British colonies of the world, be it Australia, be it whatever, you know, that is Uganda, different parts in Africa, South Africa or Sri Lanka, everywhere there are Indians. It's because this shift happened during that time. So these Indians were brought there as the people who would do the business, and because they are so good at doing it, they became the, you know, the lifeline of the country. Economics, money, flow,
right,
all happened through them. And when Idi Amin became the president, he just felt what Indians felt under British yoke, he felt that was what was happening under Indian yoke, even after Uganda had become free from the British. I'm not supporting the steps he took or the purge that he planned, but this was the reason where he felt that it is our country, our resources, our business, our money, but it's all going to these Indians. And I must say that on their part, the Indians also were not a community that freely mingled and became one with the African community, in the sense that marriages were always within the Indians. You would not see an Indian marrying an African. Very, very rare it was. So the Indians remained an isolated community, and therefore in that one decade after independence, I think Uganda became independent in 1962, they did not homogeneously blend into the society. So it was very easy to isolate and pick out the Indians. And that is when the purge began. Seeing which Bhagwan 5 years earlier had hinted and warned many people that it's time for leaving Uganda.
And whenever Swami speaks about Idi Amin, Swami would point out to this aspiration of his, you know, because his aspiration was for his people. You know, he wanted them to come up, and it would never happen when you have a foreign community which is very good at what they're doing, and the rest of the natives have a long distance to go till they come to that thing. You know, it never happens, and it happens in all societies where they have this problem. In fact, in the West, you are seeing a reverse of that happening. Right? Mm. You know, the kind of opposition which is there for immigration right now is, in a sense, that, you know, you're in many ways stealing the opportunity from your native community. And there are both ways of the argument. You can speak for it or against it.
But you can speak against or for it, but what is common, Prem, is selfishness. When it suits me, I will preach globalization. You know? And when it suits me, I will preach protectionism. So there are big brothers or, you know, in the countries also based on economies and this, who preach opening up the economy and saying that is the way we all grow. That is as long as I can grow.
Right.
And the moment I feel I am not growing, I forget about whether the world can grow or not. I say, no, let's have a closed economy. So this goes on, and naturally it is almost like might is right. and here might is economic might, and in the world today also that's what it is. Economic might seems to be the economic right. But that is where, you know, we get confidence and courage from Bhagwan's word, where he says that it's only matter of time, because finally it is moral right, moral might that will become your right. It is moral right that will be your might, you know. So we are waiting for that golden age where morality rules over everything, but until then at least selfishness is the core of everything that's happening in the world.
You know, and this situation, typically what was happening in 1968 in Uganda, is a typical situation where not necessarily one side was right and the other side was wrong. The Indian community was not completely wrong, nor was people like Idi Amin who were trying to empower their own native people. They were both right in their own way. The methods might have been wrong, or as you said, the fact that the Indian community was not necessarily empowering the local community enough was a mistake they were doing. But you can't pinpoint one generation or one particular thing. That's why Swami was favoring both in a sense, because Swami says that he did encourage Idi Amin to help his people in that sense. You know, he said, yes, you have to do what is right for your people. In that sense, Swami did say that what Idi Amin was doing was right. At the same time, Swami came to the Indian community and Swami told them, it's time for you to move out. Because Swami knew that they can always find a way of, you know, flourishing wherever they go. So Swami was doing the right thing for both communities, because, there are many times in situation in life, nobody is wrong, nobody is right. So you need to find the middle path, and that's precisely what Swami was doing in this case too.
Now let's fast forward to finish the story of Dr. Kishan Gadia. He says that though he sold away everything and, you know, made liquid everything and transferred it off to London, it was 1972 and he had not yet left the country. That was when he faced a life and death experience. He was traveling by road, by car, and as he was traveling, he was stopped by one of the Ugandan army soldiers, and he wondered what was it. The soldier came and said, I have to check your car. So Dr. Kishan said, please go ahead, because I have only my medical equipment in the car. Sure enough, the soldier went through the car and found no weapons or anything that could be suspicious or suspect, and yes, it was only a stethoscope and such things. But then he told Dr. Kishan Gadia to get out of the car, and he said, you follow me. Dr. Kishan Gadia thought that possibly he's taking me to the army camp where somebody is sick, because Dr. Kishan Gadia was well known among the people in the army, among the top brass in the Ugandan army. He was treating many of them. He was the physician for many of them. So he thought that it might be the case. But to his shock, he saw that he was taken into a part of the forest, a thick bush, made to kneel down there and had the gun put at his head, you know, a machine gun at his head. He was trembling in fear, and he just started telling that, you see, I am nothing, you know, I am just a doctor, I am trying to serve the people here. But the soldier said that, no, you are not belonging to our country and you are taking away what belongs to us, you know. So the feeling had already spread, and Dr. Gadia now was very much scared, very fearful of what would happen. He was sure he's going to lose his life. So the soldier then says, any last wishes? You got any last wish? And Dr. Gadia says that, I told him that I just want to meet my family. And the soldier says, that is not possible at all, you know. Any other last wish? Would you like to smoke a cigarette maybe, you know? And he says, no, I don't smoke. And then he says, maybe you would like to pray then. And in that interview, Dr. Gadia says that it was that soldier who reminded me of what I should actually do. You know, this is very humble of him to tell that way, but I think this is a point for all of us to keep in our mind. If, you know, they say that your thoughts during death determine your future, in your future rebirth or whether you're going to get liberated, whatever, your final thoughts before death. But let us not think that that is a shortcut, that I can do whatever I want in life and just before I die, let me think of the Lord. It is not going to happen, because what we think at the point when we are facing death is actually that thing that we have done throughout our life. If we have been chasing money throughout our life, at the point when we face death, we will actually think of money. If we have been thinking of family all our life, that is what we will think of at the point of time when we are facing death. The only way we can think of Swami when we are facing death is if we think of Swami all our life. I mean, this has been reiterated to us through multiple experiences of multiple people, and this is what Dr. Kishan Gadia said, and he began to pray.
Right, and that's when, you know, when reminded of this thing, because that man says that being an Indian, at least you should want to pray. And then he pulls out this visiting card which Swami had materialized for him.
In the wallet.
You know, which he always carried in the wallet. And he started looking at it and he started praying. And he started making his final prayers to Swami. And that's when this man saw Kishan Gadia looking at this piece of paper. And he comes and he grabs it and he starts looking at it. And he says he looks at it for a good few seconds. And then he returns it to him and he says, okay, you can go. He says, leave your card here and you go. You go away. And he's surprised because one way, on one hand he's also scared. Probably he's asking him to leave and he may be shot behind or whatever it is. But he knew that that person's, you know, demeanor had changed after he looked at Swami's picture for a few minutes. He gives it back to him and he says, you go. Leave all your things here and just leave.
In the meanwhile, something interesting happens, because one point I forgot to tell is, when this is happening, actually a taxi driver.
Right, exactly.
He drives to the spot and he sees and he starts telling, you leave him, you know, he's a doctor and all that. And the soldier shouts back at him telling that, if you try to do anything here, I will shoot you also. So this taxi driver runs away, but since he knows Dr. Kishan Gadia, he actually goes to the army headquarters and informs the superiors there that this doctor is about to be killed. So at this point in time, when he says, you just leave, Dr. Kishan Gadia is happy that he's able to walk away with his life. At precisely that time, he says that the top brass from the army arrived there. And at that point in time, he turns around to see that the soldier has fled. So actually, he doesn't leave behind. He gets back his car, everything, and he drives back home. But now he remembers what Swami had told 4 years back, that you just leave everything and go. And he decides that that very same day
he leaves, right.
He goes to his parents and tells them that, you know, you do what you wish. I am leaving now. And Swami told, actually, all of you should come. You should come. And he convinces and all of them leave. He says, I've got enough money. Everything is there. Swami will take care of everything. Let us just leave. And they had to leave. They couldn't carry anything with them. You know, they couldn't carry anything. They had to just leave behind everything with clothes on their body. That's what they did. And they left for London, and where they settled. He said that in Leicester, that's where he settled, and they were very happy. But something very interesting is, I remember this, that when we were in third UG, during one of the Tri sessions, I think 2002 it was possibly, Swami actually told Dr. Kishan Gadia to give a talk in Tri Vrindavan. And he asked Swami, can I narrate how you saved me in Uganda? Swami said, yeah, tell it. And he narrated this entire experience. After that, Bhagwan gave a discourse. And during Swami's discourse, Swami mentioned that, you know, that soldier actually had come to know of me and he had wanted my picture. And in Kampala, he had found Swami's picture. And, you know, Dr. Kishan Gadia says that those days after effect of Swami's visit to Kampala, a lot of his pictures were available all around Kampala and people would pick it up, you know, that's what he said. So this soldier, this is what Dr. Gadia didn't know, this is Swami revealing. Swami saying that this soldier found a photograph of Swami and he was very amazed and something drew him, attracted him to the photograph. It was later that this episode happened where he was about to shoot Gadia and he sees that he's having a visiting card carrying the same photograph. That's why he said he just couldn't think of harming. He left this person, but he says, after that, you know, in Thrice, Swami said, I decided to be with that soldier. So this soldier, Swami says, that carried this photograph everywhere. And one day when he was in the middle of something, Swami didn't give those details, he heard somebody laughing. And he wondered...
Swami was saying that he started praying to Swami.
Correct.
Somebody had given a bigger picture of Swami to him as a gift and... That's how he would keep it in his altar, and he had no idea of how to pray to Swami. He would just sit there and stare at Swami's picture.
And talk to Swami.
And talk to Swami, and he would, you know, Swami said that he would cry looking at Swami. That's when that episode happened where, you know, he suddenly heard a laughter in his room when he was all alone. And then when he looked up, Swami said, I went to his room, you know, I went to his place physically. This is the African trip which we can't talk about because it's not documented. Swami said, I went to him and Swami told him, you come to Puttaparthi, I will speak to you. And that's how this person eventually, you know, somebody gave him the money to travel. And Swami said he came here.
Sitting on the sands.
Right, I called him for an interview. And if I'm not wrong, I think Swami also said I gave him a rosary.
Swami gave him a robe.
Swami
gave him his robe and he was totally transformed. And it was almost like Ratnakara becoming Valmiki.
Right.
You know, that is how
Swami said that, right? And I think in Thrai when Swami spoke about this.
Swami exactly said this.
Like
how Ratnakara got transformed into Valmiki.
Valmiki.
This person who was killing people got transformed. Right. And
in fact, I think Swami says that he goes back and he becomes a completely reformed person, almost like a saint. A lot of people go to him for good company, literally in that sense.
See, that is the glory of our Lord Prem. Our Swami, we don't know how he reaches out to whom in what manner. This is so amazing. You know, we often speak of this as the life and death experience of Dr. Gadia. It is also the life and death experience of the soldier, and we are grateful to Swami that he revealed this in that Thrai session and he narrated this episode. Otherwise, we would have missed it. But it's almost like every moment, every minute, God is creating life and death situations for many people, and this situation actually becomes an opportunity for him. You know, recently I heard another story where man's adversity becomes God's opportunity. It is the brother of Dr. Sailesh Srivastava, who is currently teaching in the university. His brother, Devesh, a very successful business person today, and he's a CEO of multiple companies, he's doing extremely well. But in 1994, you know, that is the reason why I remembered Surdas drama in 1994, because that was the time when Dr. Sailesh was involved in that Surdas drama.
Okay.
Unknown to him, his brother met with a ghastly accident in the Himalayas. And he says that, I was sure that I'm going to die now. It's only a matter of time. Blood was oozing all over. And he was lying on the road 1.5 hours away from the hospital. Suddenly a Maruti van comes and there is this Sardarji, a Punjabi gentleman, who takes out his turban and bandages him and they're taking him to the hospital. It's very interesting, you know, to note what happens there. I shall go only into this part of the journey. He's lying in the back of that Maruti van and he says that one by one I was feeling my senses leaving me. First my vision went, then my sense of hearing went off, then I couldn't smell anything. Finally it reached a point where I can't even feel anything. And yet I know that I am there. You know, what a experience it is. You don't smell anything, see anything, touch anything, feel anything, and yet you know you are there. And he says, at that point in time, again, I am slowly exiting my own body. This is possibly what we call death. And he says, as I am exiting it, I heard a voice which said, chant the Gayatri Mantra. And he began to chant Om Bhur Bhuvah Swaha. Even as he started Om Bhur Bhuvah Swaha, he says, the van seemed to transform into Prashanti Nilayam. And he was in the presence of Swami standing there with his hands raised in Abhaya Hasta, almost saying, why fear when I am here? This vision, whatever you call it, it was so thrilling, so magnificent. He continued to chant the Gayatri Mantra. He chanted it for a second time. And he says, as he completed chanting the Gayatri Mantra the third time, the entire vision vanished. His senses returned and he was back in the Maruti van. And amazingly, he had reached the hospital. You know, he knew that it takes 1.5 hours to reach the hospital, but he had reached it in the matter of 3 Gayatri Mantras. So, you know, narrating about this, Dr. Sailesh Srivastava, later, you know, it has a second part also where in the interview room, Swami revealed many things about the accident. But the whole experience is summed up by the statement what his brother, you know, Dr. Sailesh Srivastava said. He said that man's adversity is God's opportunity. It is possibly because only in an adverse situation we open up ourselves to God. We realize that there are things in life that is beyond our control. Our ego takes a hammering, we become humble. And as Christ said, he who humbles himself will be exalted. That is what the Lord does. And therefore, man's adversity becomes God's opportunity. It has been proved time and again, and it was proved even in the life of Dr. Kishan Gadia, who escaped from the soldier. And at the same time, it turned out to be the same case for even that soldier. Adversity became God's opportunity to enter his life.
You know, there is a saying which they say, the common phrase, the tip of the iceberg, which they say. And someone was talking about icebergs, he said, even the tip of the iceberg is actually an exaggeration, because the iceberg that you see is actually the tip of the iceberg. Because the major part of the iceberg is unseen, it's underwater. What is seen is actually the tip of the iceberg. And when you say tip of the iceberg, you mean the tip of the tip. Right? And that's precisely what it is when you talk about Swami. Because, you know, you're talking about this elaborate African trip, and we know, you know, morning Swami did this, afternoon Swami did this, before lunch he met these people, after lunch he met these people, he went here, he went there. You know, that's the documented part, but the undocumented part is like infinite. You know, how many such people have been transformed, how many such people have been given the opportunity, and they've grabbed the opportunity. You know, that's endless. That's probably the part which will never be part of any satsang. This is one thing which Swami revealed. There's one incident which Swami revealed, and it fills us with so much bliss even thinking of it 40 years later, 50 years later. And, you know, that's why we sitting here in Radio Sai can never do justice. And that's why a poet says, you know, if you make the entire ocean into ink, all the trees into pens, and the entire sky into paper, you still can't.
And even do if justice. Goddess of learning, Saraswati herself, were to write, the glories of the Lord cannot be written.
So I think we will be excused in our inability to do justice.
On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. We offer our humble gratitude to Bhagwan for this wonderful opportunity to think about Him, to speak about Him, to feel Him in our hearts. We will end now with a bhajan, on the other side of which will be the segment by Brother Chandu, that is Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.